Okay, so we've been looking at some of Rambam's, let's call them publicistic works. If you remember from last week, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik actually called them propagandistic. I prefer publicistic. Somehow it sounds less nefarious than propaganda. So we spent some time looking at one of his earliest works from his youthful years in North Africa, the Igeret Hashmad, the letter that he wrote on account of the persecution and forcible conversions that the Almohads had inflicted upon Jews in North Africa and in southern Spain. And we saw that he was not deterred by the fact that another rabbi, who clearly, implicitly, at this point in time, certainly was older than Maimonides and probably a more established person than Maimonides, the fact that this rabbi had written to the contrary did not deter Rambam from expressing his own opinion. This week, and next week as well, we'll turn to perhaps the best known of all of these igrot, of all of these monographs, the one that's called Igeret Teiman. And that is a letter that Rambam wrote to, not to all of the Jews of Yemen, although, as we'll see, he certainly wanted the letter to be circulated amongst them. But as we'll see very shortly, the letter did have a particular and individual recipient. So first of all, let's just get some or refresh our individual or collective memories about just what or where Yemen is. So Yemen is at the very tip of the Arabian Peninsula. As you see on the map here, Yemen is on the west of Yemen is the Red Sea. To the south of Yemen are both the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. Okay. North of Yemen is Saudi Arabia. Okay. Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, you see it here with the larger, bolder print, is where most of Yemenite Jews lived. But there were Jews in other areas of Yemen as well, particularly some closer to the coastal areas, like in Aden, here at the very south. Because one of the things that Jews of Yemen did, apart from being accomplished goldsmiths and silversmiths, is that they also participated in international commerce. The next slide will show Yemen in conjunction with some of the countries around it. So you see again to the north of Yemen is Saudi Arabia, and right across the Red Sea from Yemen, in fact, at the point at which the Red Sea is at its narrowest, are some of the provinces of Eastern Africa, Eritrea, Ethiopia. North of Ethiopia and Eritrea is the Sudan. North of Sudan is Egypt. So if you want to get some idea of how did Maimonides send letters to Yemen? It's really not all that difficult. All Maimonides really had to do was, so to speak, drop the letter in the mailbox in Cairo, okay, from which it would go overland to the Red Sea, right? Overland here, this is the Gulf of Aqaba, okay? So it would either go to the Gulf of Aqaba or to the Gulf of Suez, and there it would be loaded onto a boat. And the boat would take it down the Red Sea to Yemen. Now, if I go back just for a moment to the previous slide, having reached here the Mandab Straits that separate the Arabian Peninsula from Eastern Africa, the boat then would either conclude its journey here in Aden, or as likely as not, it would continue on through the Gulf of Aden and through the Arabian Sea, and it would go off this map until it arrived in India. In fact, the late Shlomo Dov Goitein, who in his lifetime was the dean of Geniza studies and who had a particular interest in social and economic history, actually wrote a book called The India Trade, which was the result of his study of hundreds of Geniza fragments that illustrated the prominent role that was played by Jewish merchants in the India trade, that is to say, in trading between Europe and India. Things would come from Europe. Now we can move back to the next map. Things would come from Europe across the Mediterranean to North Africa. They would either come directly to Alexandria in Egypt, or they would take a shorter trip to North Africa, and then they would go overland to Alexandria. Then they would go along the Nile from Alexandria south until eventually they would be loaded again upon those ships that would take them through the Red Sea and then through the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea into the Indian Ocean and to India and back again. Okay. So what happened, what was going on in Yemen during the lifetime of Maimonides, and to which Maimonides responded in his Igeret Teman, in his letter to the Yemenites, were two related phenomena. The common denominator in both of these is messianism. The somewhat secondary distinction between them is that one was the appearance in Yemen of people proclaiming themselves to be the Messiah, a phenomenon that's known as false messianism. Okay. And the related phenomenon was that Yemenite Jews had in their possession a number of traditions by which they attempted to calculate the Messianic age, so that at one and the same time, there were people who were proclaiming themselves erroneously to be the Messiah, but yet there were people who were calculating the advent of the Messianic age. And apparently, there often these two phenomena occasionally coincided, so that somebody would proclaim himself to be a Messiah precisely at a time at which there were people who were expecting the Messiah to arrive. Today, I'm going to talk about false messianism and talk about several of the false messianic movements that Maimonides wrote about in his Igeret Teman. Next week, we'll talk more specifically about these traditions regarding the calculation of the Messianic age. But simply to give you an illustration of how these two phenomena can occasionally coincide, I'll use something more modern than Maimonides. I'll use as an example, perhaps the best known of all of the false messiahs in Jewish history, the example of Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi made his initial appearance as the Messiah in the year 1648. Why in the year 1648? Because the year 1648, not coincidentally, was one of those points in time at which messianic expectations were at their highest. Why? First thing we have to do is recognize that, of course, the year 1648 of the Common Era has no significance as a number, has no significance in Jewish history. First thing we have to do is we have to translate the year 1648 into the Jewish year. If you don't know how to translate years of the common era into years to the creation of the world, take, for example, our current year as an example. Forget the thousand digit and just look at the hundreds and tens and ones. So this is the year 022, and it corresponds to the year 782. The difference between 782 and 022 is 240. So the truth of the matter is that at any time, the last three digits of the year according to the common era and the year according to the creation of the world is a difference of 240. Then, of course, depending upon how far back you're going in time, the thousands digit can come into play also. So if we take the year 648, okay, and we subtract 240, we get 408. Okay. And since it's still in the same millennium as we are in today, it would have been on the Jewish calendar the year 5408. Now, one way in which you can depict the year 5408 using gematria, using alphanumerics, right, using the notion that every letter of the Hebrew alphabet is also assigned a numerical value, is that 5000 is represented by the letter He. Okay? 400 is represented by the letter Tav. But there's more than one way to get the numeral 8. You can get the numeral 8 simply by using the letter Chet of the Hebrew alphabet. But you can also produce the value of 8 by having 7 and 1. So, if you take the letter Zion, which is 7, and the letter Aleph, which is 1, and you put the He for 5,000 in front of it, and you put the Tav for 400 after it, you get the Hebrew word Hazot. He, Zion, Aleph, Tav, whose numerical value is 5,408. Okay. Now, why was that year, the year 5,408, according to the Jewish calendar, a year of heightened messianic expectations? Because a verse in the book of Vayikra that talks about the Jubilee year, a year in which slaves go free, a year in which people who had to sell their land, it returns to them, meaning a year where one might say that a lot of social and economic imbalances are corrected, okay? A pretty good model for the messianic era. The verse says, Bishnat hayovel hazot, tashuvu ish el achuzato. In this Jubilee year, everyone will return to his inheritance. So because numerical value of Hazot was 5,408, that made that year, corresponding to the year 1648 of the Common Era, a year of heightened messianic expectations. Therefore, it is not at all coincidental that that was the year in which Shabtai Tzvi chose to reveal himself as the Messiah. Okay, so as I said, we're going to talk more about calculations next week. But today we're going to talk about false messianism. So since we understand, due to our prior classes, that Rambam was indeed a man of his time, that he was sensitive to and responsive to the social and cultural facts of life amongst Jews who lived in the Muslim world in the Middle Ages. Just as we took some time at the beginning to talk about the attitude of Islam towards Judaism and the attitude of Muslims towards Jews. I'm going to take a couple of moments now to talk a little bit about whether the concept of messianism, the idea not only of an era of redemption, but of a figure who will lead that era of redemption, whether it has any meaning or any value in the specific context of the Muslim world. So we have to go back a little to the death of Muhammad in the year 632. Muhammad had no sons. Arguably, if he had a son, the son would have succeeded him because that is, you'll excuse the expression, the code of the desert. Okay. But since Muhammad had no sons, he had but a daughter, okay, Fatima, he was succeeded by the people who were closest to him. I guess the people who were regarded by his followers as being the ones to whom Muhammad would turn for advice, the ones who already in Muhammad's lifetime were already exercising some sort of religious and national authority. So he was succeeded first by a companion named Abu Bakr. Second, then, after the death of Abu Bakr, by yet another one of his companions named Omar, the one after whom the mosque in Jerusalem, correctly known as the Dome of the Rock, is often called. And the third of his companions to succeed him was Uthman. If the word Uthman sounds a little familiar, it's the Arabic pronunciation of what we better know in Turkish as Ottoman. Okay. Now, these three companions of Muhammad, when they succeeded him, assumed the title of caliph, related to the Hebrew word lahachalif, meaning to substitute. When Uthman was assassinated in the year 656, he was succeeded by Ali. Ali was Muhammad's cousin and was also married to Muhammad's daughter Fatima, making him Muhammad's son-in-law. Now, Ali's succession was opposed by one of the leading tribes that had joined the Muslim nation, the Umayyads. And the result was a civil war between those who followed Ali and those who followed the Umayyads. And it led several years later in 661 to Ali's assassination. This is the beginning of the division amongst Muslims that appears so frequently in the news, right? Those who remained faithful to the Umayyads, right, who were related also to, came from the same clan as Muhammad, and who came to be known as Sunni, which means traditionalists, and those who supported the sons of Ali, who were regarded by the majority as rebelling against the authority. And they came to be known as Shiites. The word Shia, similar to the modern Hebrew word Si'ah, which means like a political party, designated them as Ali's partisans. When Hussein, one of Ali's sons, was killed in a battle, one of these civil war battles, in the year 680, that initiated amongst the Shiites, amongst the partisans of Ali, a tradition of martyrdom. Very much in the tradition that that we read about in the in the news today. Okay. Let's go back. Now, Muslims, per se, have no institution comparable to a Beit Mikdash, and therefore, they never experienced anything comparable to the Khurban, to its destruction. Furthermore, since their initial attempts at conquest during the 7th and 8th centuries, were rewarded with success, and a success that remained unchanged over most of their early history, So they also never experienced anything comparable to galut, to exile. As a result, Sunni Muslims generally are unconcerned with either the concept of redemption in general, because they see nothing from which they need to be redeemed, nor are they concerned with the concept of a Messiah that, as I said, is an individual who will be prominent during this age of redemption. A very different situation exists amongst the Shiites. Because the roots of Shiism lie in its failure historically to realize its political aspirations, because the sons of Ali were unable to succeed their father as a caliph, and furthermore, on account of the fact that their leaders were cruelly killed during these civil war battles, Shiite Islam developed a tradition of suffering, torment, affliction, including self-flagellation, that is, whipping themselves, and alongside it, an aspiration towards future and ultimate redemption. Indeed, the most important religious idea of Shiism is the belief in a Messiah-like figure called the Mahdi, Arabic for one who is divinely guided, who they believe will restore Muslim rule to whom? To the descendants of Muhammad through Ali, and will usher in the equivalent of the Acharit HaYamim, the end of days. It's not surprising, therefore, that during the Gaonic era, from, let's say, the 7th century through the 11th century, and the early medieval period, extending into the from the 11th through the 12th, and probably just till about the middle or the end of the 13th century, Jewish history in the orbit of Islam was replete with episodes of sectarianism, that is, Jews divided amongst themselves in some of the same ways that Muslims were divided, and false messianism. These instances occurring primarily, although not exclusively, in areas of Shiite influence. Now you see how we end up in Yemen. Yemen is a predominantly Shiite country, as in fact is also Persia. The 12th century, Rambam's lifetime in particular, saw what we would call an outbreak of messianic fervor, due in large part to the fact that ordinary Jewish life in the Middle East had been interrupted beginning with the late 11th century on account of the Crusades. In fact, the clash between the Holy Roman Empire or Christendom on the one hand and Islam on the other served for many people as a backdrop for the increased speculation and anticipation of redemption. And here we see an example. This is called Nistarot Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Nistarot, hidden things. And you remember that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is regarded traditionally as the author of the Zohar, a book full of secrets and mysteries. So this is not something written or attributed. It is attributed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but it certainly wasn't written by him. It's a medieval work, and it's in Hebrew. And this is just a translation of a selection from it that, as I said, will just simply illustrate how the background of world history that pitted East against West during this period of time, the end of the 11th and the first half of the 12th century, was regarded by Jews as an particularly auspicious time for the appearance of the Messiah. Rabbi Shimon said, "How will salvation, Yeshua, come at the hands of the Yishmaelim? Mitatron, the archangel, said, God will provide them, that is to say, the Arabs, with a prophet, obviously a reference to Mohammed, who will conquer the land of Israel for them They will rebuild ruined cities, clear the roads, plant gardens and orchards, and then what are they going to do? They will return the land to the Jewish people. Now, of course, that never happened, right? But things that were somewhat representative or symbolic of this did happen. Look at the next paragraph. The second king of Yishmael, that would be the second caliph, right? Remember, when Mohammed died, his first successor, Abu Bakr, was the first caliph. The second successor was Omar, right? So the second king of Yishmael, that would be the caliph Omar, will conquer all the empires. And indeed, he was the great conqueror. He will come to Jerusalem and worship there. As I mentioned, the reason that the Dome of the Rock is often commonly but erroneously called the Mosque of Omar is because, according to Muslim tradition, Omar did come to Jerusalem and he actually prayed there. In fact, according to an accepted Muslim tradition, where in Jerusalem did the Caliph Omar choose to pray? He summoned a Jewish convert to Islam to help him identify the place on which the temple stood. So if you ever wonder about why Muslims are so attached to Jerusalem, okay, part of it has to do with the fact that that one of the names of Jerusalem, okay, you may know if you visited Israel, of course, that the Arabic name for Jerusalem is Al-Quds, right, the holy place. But the Temple Mount in particular is known in early Muslim literature by an even more specific name. It's actually called Bayt al-Maqdis, which sounds very much like what it is, Bayt HaMikdash. Okay. This brings us to the Igeret Teiman. I always like to bring the front piece of a book, of a published work that we're looking at. And you may wonder, why did I choose this one? Because if you take a look at the very last line on the page, it says New York. And after New York, it says Tav Shin Yud. Now, we've already had an exercise today in translating years according to the creation of the world into years according to the common era. So if we take Tav, which is 400, Shin, which is 700, 300, we get 700, okay? And Yod is 10, okay? Add 240 to 710, and what do you get? You get 950. Okay, so this was published in New York in the year 1950. Okay, so notice, in New York City in 1950, okay, somebody could afford to publish the Hebrew text. And that's not an original Hebrew text. It's the Hebrew translation of an Arabic original. Okay, but somebody could afford to publish the Hebrew version of Maimonides' Igeret Teiman in a series that's called, look at the top of the page, Sifriya Lemit Lamedim. This was not published as a text to be used by doctoral students specializing in the history of Jews in the Middle Ages or specializing in medieval Jewish philosophy. It was not even published per se for to be used by students in Yeshiva College or Stern College. Right? This was published, as you see again on the bottom, Hotzaat Histadrut Ivrit Ba'America. This was published under the auspices of an organization whose goal was to get ordinary Jews to learn Hebrew. So imagine that just 70 years ago, somebody thought that an ordinary knowledge of Hebrew was enough to be able to read Rambam's Igeret Teiman. And that'll tell you something either about how far we've come since 1950, or tell you something about unrealistic expectations being at least 70 years old. In any event, here is the very opening of it. And again, as I said, just bear in mind that the text was written originally in Arabic, And this is a Hebrew translation. In fact, the very second line of the text will introduce us to the translator. It starts off, Igeret Teman laharam bamzal, write the letter to Yemen by Maimonides, right? He'etika. It was copied. And this doesn't just mean copied in the sense of writing the letters one after each other. It probably also carries the significance of translation. Rabbi Nahum Ma'aravi, zichrono livracha, that this was translated from Arabic into Hebrew by somebody called Rabbi Nahum Ma'aravi. Ma'aravi is not an uncommon family name or place name identifying Jews of Morocco. V'kara Shema Petach Tikva. That is to say that while we are referring to this letter as Igeret Teman, one of its earliest translators into Hebrew gave it a different name. He called it the letter of Petach Tikva. Petach Tikva literally means the opening or gateway of hope. Because as we'll see, Rambam's purpose in writing this was to build up the morale of Yemenite Jewry that had been weakened on account of their having to contend with all of these appearances of false messiahs. Mini, from me, Ano, Moshe, Rabbi Maimon, Hadayan, Rabbi Yosef, Hacham, Rabbi Yitzchak, Harab, Rabbi Ovadia, Hadayan, Zichrono Livracha. So here we have Maimonides, Yichos, right? His father was Maimon, his grandfather was Yosef, his great-grandfather was Yitzchak, his great-great-grandfather was Ovadia, and notice that they were also like officials in the Jewish community. His father was a Dayan, okay? His great-great-grandfather was a Dayan, and Nebuch, his grandfather, was only a Chacham. So what can you do? Okay. Now, what's his opening? And why did the translator call it Petach Tikva, the gateway to hope? Because look at his opening. Chizku yadayim rafot ubirkayim koshelot imitsu. Strengthened hands that have been weakened and fortified knees that are shaking. Lekavod gadol v'kadosh mar Rav Yaakov hechacham hanechma. Now here we have the name of the person to whom the letter was addressed. Okay. And that is, his name is Yaakov, and he is ben kvod mav rav Netanel. So it written to somebody named Yaakov, son of someone named Netanel, ben Alfayumi. Okay. Alfayumi means the person who comes from Fayum. Fayum is an oasis some 50 miles southwest of Cairo. It also happens to be a place where during the High Middle Ages, the 10th and 11th centuries, was the home to a lot of Jews, and particularly the home to several very well-known Jews, the best known of whom was Saadia Gaon. Saadia was born in the oasis of Fayum and grew up there. And therefore he, like this Yaakov ben Netanel, throughout his life, was often called HaFayumi, the person who comes from Fayum. Now that also may mean that this is a family that was, although it was situated now in Yemen, it's a family that apparently, until perhaps only recently, had lived in Egypt. So it could very well be that Rambam, in writing to this Yaakov ben Netanel HaFayumi, didn't just simply pick his name out of the Yemenite phone book, so to speak, but that he was writing to him because he either knew him personally, or perhaps he had an acquaintance with his father or his grandfather while they were still living in Egypt, not far from Cairo. Okay, the first of the messianic pretenders about whom Rambam speaks. And Rambam is not our only source of information about this messianic pretender. In fact, it's curious. Not only is there information about him in Jewish sources, there's information about him in Muslim sources as well. His name was Abu Isa, and he came from the Persian city of Isfahan. Remember, again, as we said, Yemen and Persia, being two predominantly Shiite countries, happened to be more fertile ground for messianism than other Sunni Muslim countries. Abu Isa is a very unusual name for a Jew to bear, because Isa is usually the Arabic equivalent of Jesus. And somehow for a Jew to be called Abu Isa, you know, there's something already there in the name that kind of shouts out to you and says, be careful. In any event, what is the background? The background is that in the year 750, the middle of the 8th century, the Umayyads were defeated by another rival Muslim dynasty called the Abbasids. The Abbasids, by the way, built the city of Baghdad, which became their capital. The Umayyads had ruled out of the city of Damascus. So the Abbasids came to power in the 8th century, and their revolutionary propaganda also stressed, as it were, the coming of a new age. As I said, one of the reasons that they built a new city was kind of like to say, you know, we're leaving everything old behind us and everything is changing. Following the murder of a prominent Abbasid leader around this time, local insurrections broke out. Details are poorly known, but against this background, we find that a man named, or who was referred to by others as Abu Isa, started a movement which was named after him, and they were called either the followers of Abu Isa, or it's the tendency of historians to call them Isawites. Okay? In Arabic, they're called Isawiya, right? And they're called the followers or whatever the movement that founded by Abu Isa. And according to some of the sources, he had no fewer than 10,000 followers. And these weren't just people who, you know, who decided, oh, what's the difference? You know, I'll just follow Abu Isa. They had to make a commitment to him. And the commitment occasionally required them to go to fight, to go to battle on his behalf. Until eventually he and many of his followers were killed by one of the Abbasid caliphs. And again, something that we see often, not only in Jewish messianic pretenders, but also in messianic movements amongst Muslims and even amongst Christians, his followers believe that he didn't really die, that his death was an illusion, and that in reality, he was able to disappear, okay? And therefore, right, since he really didn't die, they could anticipate his return. Here's the text from the Igeret Teiman. I shall now narrate to you succinctly several episodes subsequent to the rise of the Arabic kingdom, from which you will derive some benefit. So basically, Rambam's giving them a history lesson. One of these refers to the exodus of a multitude of Jews, numbering hundreds of thousands, not merely 10,000, hundreds of thousands, from the east beyond Isfahan, that is to say, in some of the more remote provinces of Persia, led by an individual who pretended to be the Messiah. They were accoutred with military equipment. This is not my English translation. They were accoutred with military equipment. As we pointed out already, they engaged in battle, drawn swords, and slew all those that encountered them. They reached, according to the information I received, the vicinity of Baghdad. This happened when? In the beginning of the reign of the Umayyads, when the sages met these Jews, meaning the sages living more in the more conventional areas of Jewish settlement, right? In what we would call either Bavel or Eretz Yisrael, met these Jews who came from some of the furthest east provinces of Persia, they ask them, who instigated you to make this uprising? Meaning, take me to your leader. Whereupon they replied, this man here, the one we know as Abu Isa, whom they claimed was a descendant of David, whom we know to be pious and virtuous. Now, why do they think that he was a Messiah? They claim that this man, whom we knew to be a leper, a mitzorah, a leper at night, arose the following morning healthy and sound. They believe that leprosy, or the ability to cure leprosy, was one of the characteristics of the Messiah. Now, they pose the threat not only to the Jewish community, if indeed they were only false messianists, but because they were armed, and there were arguably so many of them, they clearly posed a threat to the Muslim authorities as well, which is, of course, why there are Muslim sources about this as well. So we're told, and Maimonides says, that the Sultan, by who he means the ruler, the Abbasid ruler, turned over to them so and so many thousands of dinars by way of hospitality, meaning in order that they should leave his country. But after they returned home, the Sultan had a change of heart with respect to the Jews, upon whom he imposed a fine for his expenditures, meaning he made the Jews living in the Middle East cough up the money that he gave to these followers of Abu Isa, who arguably had returned to Persia. Not only that, he took it out on them by ordering them to make a special mark on their garments. Yes, the yellow badge could be found amongst Jews living in some Muslim countries long before the 20th century. And the writing of the word cursed, and to attach an iron bar in the back and one in the front. Ever since then, the communities of Khorasan, which is again one of the eastern provinces of Persia, and Isfahan, experienced the tribulations of the diaspora. So this is Rambam's recapitulation of this somewhat striking instance of false messianism. The second case that he narrates of false messianism is somewhat more subdued. It's also much more recent. About 50 years ago, right, that would put it early in the 12th century, a pious and virtuous man, right, not a pretender, I mean, not somebody with no background, a scholar by the name of Moses al-Dar'i, came from Dar'a, right, wherever that is, to the province of Andalusia, that is, he came to Spain, to study under Rabbi Yosef Halevi ibn Migash, of whom you have very likely heard, meaning this was somebody of stature. This was somebody who could pass the entrance exam to what at the time was the highest yeshiva in Spain. Later, that is after studying in Spain, he left for Fez, right, in North Africa, the center of the Maghreb. People flocked to him because of his piety, virtue, and learning. He informed them, his followers, that the Messiah had come, as was divinely revealed to him in a dream. Yet, he did not pretend based on a divine communication, as did the former lunatic, that he was the Messiah, right? Meaning, somehow he said to them, this is a messianic era, but he didn't present himself as the Messiah. He merely affirmed that the Messiah had appeared. Many people became his adherents and reposed faith in him. Now, Rambam tells us that his father of blessed memory, Maimon, endeavored to dissuade and discourage people from following him. However, only a few were influenced by my father, while most, nay, nearly all, clung to Rabbi Moses of blessed memory. See now, even 50 years after this, Rambam is citing this as an example of false messianic expectations. But his impression is that this Moses al-Dar'i himself still deserves to be called of blessed memory. Finally, he predicted events which came true, no matter what was going to occur. He would say, I was informed yesterday that this and this would happen, and it did happen exactly as he foretold. He does not give us any details about what are these kinds of events that he was able to foretell. So we really have no way of judging whether he was able to foretell them simply because he was an astute reader of tea leaves, so to speak, or whether indeed he possessed some prophetic ability. The result was that when the majority of people put their trust in him, he predicted that the Messiah would come that very year on the eve of Pesach, on Erev Pesach. So he advised people to sell their property and to contract debts to the Muslims with the promise to pay back 10 dinars for one in order to observe the precepts of the Torah in connection with the Passover festival, for they will never see them again. Meaning, go into debt if you want to, because the Messiah will come. He'll take us all back to the land of Israel. And of course, you won't have to repay your debts. When Passover came and nothing transpired, the people who had followed his advice were ruined, as most of them had disposed of their property for a trifling sum and were now overwhelmed with debt. When the Gentiles in the vicinity and their serfs learned of this hoax, they were minded to do away with him had they located him. As this Muslim country no longer offered him protection, he, that is Moses, al-Dari, left for Palestine, where he died. Notice again, Rambam ends this segment by referring to him as, may his memory be blessed. So it's not only people whom he calls lunatics, who might be false, who might be messianic pretenders, but even people who could qualify as Torah scholars and sages. Here's a third. Okay, my father, again of blessed memory, told me that about 15 or 20 years before that episode, that would place it at the very beginning of the 12th century, there lived respectable folks in Cordova, Spain, the center of Andalusia, some of whom were given to the cult of astrology. They were all of one mind that the Messiah would appear that year. They sought a revelation in a dream night after night and ascertained that the Messiah was a man of that city. Well, that helps. And they ought to look any further than Cordova. They picked a pious and virtuous man by the name of Ibn Aryeh, who had been instructing the people. He was a teacher. They wrought miracles and made predictions, just as al-Dari did, until they won over the hearts of the people. When the influential, learned men of our community heard of this, they assembled in the synagogue, and Ibn Aryeh was brought before them, and they administered lashes to him. Furthermore, they imposed a fine on him and put him into cherem, because by his silence, he had given assent to the professions of his adherents, meaning that he had aided and abetted in this false messianic movement, instead of restraining them and pointing out to them that what they were doing is in contradiction to the religion. And the rabbis did the same thing to the persons who would assemble about him, to his followers, and the Jews escaped the wrath of the Gentiles only with greatest difficulty. So we see that the Jews were troubled by these messianic pretenders, not only internally in terms of how they affected the Jewish community, but also how they affected the relations between Jews and their Muslim hosts. And finally, here's one instance that did not take place in a Muslim country. It took place in a Christian country. About 40 years preceding the affair of Ibn Aryeh in Andalusia, that would make it the middle of the 11th century, there appeared a man in Lyon, a large center in the heart of France, which numbered more than 10,000 Jewish families, and he too pretended that he was the Messiah, who was supposed to have performed the following miracles. And again, the details, again, you know, if you're interested, you can read them on your own. I just see that we're drawing close to a close, and there are a couple of things that I do want to, yes. So notice what it says here towards the bottom of the page. Let's look about six lines from the bottom. Okay. Therefore, he, that is to say, this messianic pretender in Lyon, admonished and adjured, right, the Jews of Lyon in metaphorical language. Okay. What did he say to them? He read them a verse in the book of Songs, in Shir HaShirim. Hishbati etchem benot Yerushalayim bitzvaot o ba'ilot ha'sadeh im ta'iru ve'im ta'oruru et ha'ahava ad she'techpas. I mention this only because this is the source of the passage that we know here from one of the early Midrashim, Shir HaShirim Rabbah. This is the source of the famous, or if you wish, infamous Arba Shavuot, the four oaths that ostensibly God administered four oaths to the Jewish people. Hishbi'al Yisrael, first, Shelo Yimrudu Ol Malchuyo, the Jews should not rebel against the Gentile kingdoms to which they were exiled. The second oath, Shelo Yidchaku Al Haketz, that they should not accelerate the end of days. And then, again, we're going to talk about these messianic calculations, these attempts, as it were, to accelerate the end of days in the next class. Third, Shelo Yigalu Mastirin Shelahem Lu'umot Ha'olam, not to reveal Jewish secrets to the Gentiles. And four, Shelo Ya'alu Choma Min Ha'Golah, which is taken to mean not to ascend, not to enter the land, not to leave exile forcibly. And the reason that I mention this is because this often appears in anti-Zionist literature, particularly anti-Zionist literature of the religious anti-Zionist persuasion, claiming that Zionism it negates Jewish tradition because it advocates for the forcible entry of Jews, exit of Jews from the diaspora into the land of Israel. And here in the final slide, notice that Rambam again says to his to this Netan El Hafayumi, I beg you to send a copy of this letter to every community in the cities, that is the large concentrations of Jews, in the hamlets, the small concentrations of Jews. Again, the purpose, in order to strengthen the people in their faith, right? Petach Tikva, and to put them on their feet, is again, as I said, to restore the morale of the people. Read it at public gatherings and in private, and you will thus become a public benefactor. And a warning that we also saw in the Igeret Hashmad, take adequate precautions lest its contents be divulged to the Gentiles by an evil purpose and mishap overtake us. Okay, have a look at the okay. Here we go. What do we have here? Was Jerusalem added as a holy site because no access to Mecca and Medina occurs? No. As a matter of fact, I mentioned this the first week. If you're acquainted with the term, the direction in which Muslims face in prayer, a direction that is indicated in mosques by a very ornate kind of artistry, is called the Qibla. Okay? It's related to the Aramaic word lokveil, which means opposite. So the Qibla is the direction that you stand opposite in prayer. Okay, in Muslim sources, Jerusalem is called the first Qibla, meaning that there is a Muslim tradition that even before Mecca was designated as the direction to which Muslims should turn in prayer, they had previously been instructed to turn to Jerusalem. Chacham could, nowadays it's more of a modern convenience to refer to a rabbi as a chacham. I suspect that when it appears in the context with other people being called dayanim and rabbanim, then it's simply to show that this was a person of perhaps outstanding knowledge, but not someone who held an official position. Yeah, so the different versions, as I said, that's why I actually brought this, because it's used more commonly referred to as the Arba Shvuot, as the four oaths. I'm sorry, did I skip something here? May it be assumed that all who are named Hussein are Shiites, or is that a name tribute to martyrdom? No, not at all. The King Hussein of Jordan is according to his tradition, a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. He is a Sharif. a direct descendant of Mohammed. So he's not called Hussein for that reason. Hassan, Hussein in Arabic means fine, upstanding. I don't think it necessarily conveys anything more than that. Okay, there we are. Don't know whether Ismaya back with us or am I once again just, there you are.
Thank you so much. I guess that's it for today. All good. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the correction earlier. That's all I have to say for now. And thank you for the incredible class.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Chodesh Tov. Thank you, Shabbat Shalom.
Yes, thank you very much.
Tomorrow is the yard site of Aharon HaKohen, which is part of this week's parsha.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
Shabbat
you.
Shabbat Shalom. Chodesh Tov. Moshe.